Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the Clinical Radiology Podcast hosted by myself, Dr. Kirthani Muthuswamy. This week I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Thomas Barge and we'll be discussing his article in the journal around pelvic venous insufficiency and the role of radiology in this condition. So to start with, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us about your background and particularly your interest in this topic?
So Tom Barge, I'm a interventional radiology SD5 trainee based in Oxford. And so I've become interested in this area through IR, really. So IR has quite a pivotal role to play in this condition in terms of embolization. And that's how I've kind of ended up becoming interested in it. I've also got interest in GU and GI imaging. So it ties in quite nicely. Essentially, it kind of came about just through the experience of several cases that I was involved with, and then discussing that with several of the consultants, and then having a look in the literature, and realizing it actually can be a bit of a confusing area, particularly in terms of the imaging diagnosis and also then the subsequent clinical decision making in terms of when to manage these patients. That's kind of where I came from and how I've kind of interested in the area.
And as you've just said, and as you've said in the article as well, symptomatic pelvic venous insufficiency may be something that's not very well understood widely. So could you start by telling us a bit about the condition itself and the proposed pathophysiology?
Yeah, so I think it's a confusing area in many ways, I think. I think firstly, the area that's quite confusing is the terminology. And as you mentioned, symptomatic pelvic venous insufficiency, it doesn't really roll off the tongue, but there's been lots of phrases and eponymous names which have been used previously. Things like pelvic venous congestion have been typically used. And then it also has crossover with things like Mayfirner and Nutcracker, which all are useful as a descriptor in a way, but they are rather non-specific and can be used in different ways. And so that's the first area I think that's quite confusing with it. I think generally the way that I've kind of tried to work through it is to think about it in the underlying pathophysiology from it and the symptoms that the patient gets. So it's one cause of chronic pelvic pain, of which there are many, and that has difficulties because there's lots of overlap in the symptomatology in this, but also in many of the other causes. So anything from other gynecological causes such as endometriosis to other GU etiologies or neurological causes of pain, for example. It's typically considered to be pain that exists for about 6 months or greater. And it's thought that the etiology behind it is possibly a combination of factors, but most likely related to both the dilation in the pelvic venous reservoirs and also hormonal factors are likely to play a role. So this has come about from studies that demonstrated that in pregnancy, the pelvic venous capacity can increase by up to about 60 times compared with non-pregnant controls. And that doesn't decrease back to pre-partum volumes. And that also ties in with the fact that pelvic venous insufficiency symptoms are more common in women and multiparous women in comparison to women that have never had children. And then there's also hormonal factors where estrogen is known to be a venodilator, and progesterone also seems to have some role in causing valvular degeneration in higher concentrations. And the fact that the symptoms in this condition can be cyclical and are more common in women who have higher concentrations of female sex hormones, so for example in polycystic ovaries, points towards a role for the hormonal factors. And then it's thought that then this dilation in the venous reservoirs probably then activate stretch receptors, and there may be other neurohormonal factors at play as well. I think that's as far as my appreciation of it is that it's actually a relatively poorly understood area And there's lots of confusion sometimes because of the overlap with other symptoms, and sometimes the somewhat imprecise descriptors that are used to try and define the syndrome.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Clearly, it's quite a complex and ambiguous topic sometimes, so you explained that really clearly, and I certainly found that really helpful. Would you be able to tell us what some of the causes of pelvic venous insufficiency might be?
So again, can be a confusing area. I think categorizing it broadly into two categories is helpful. So by far the most common is primary venous incompetence. And it's analogous with varicoceles in male patients, whereby typically the ovarian veins are affected, but it can also involve branches of the internal iliac, particularly around the para-uterine systems. And it's thought in the same way with varicoceles that probably a combination of valvular degeneration or other causes of insufficiency, plus then, as we mentioned, the venous dilation and the combination of female sex hormone effects likely lead to incompetence of these vessels, and therefore increase in the back pressure in the pelvic venous reservoirs. The other area that can cause very similar clinical symptoms but has a very different etiology is the secondary obstructive causes. And these are what have been previously referred to as things like Mayfirner compression. So that typically involves compression of the left common iliac vein under the traversing common iliac artery in the sacrum, which causes stenosis of that vein and is typically linked to lower limb symptoms. So it's most commonly associated with a iliofemoral DVT and associated venous claudication. But it can also cause effects on the internal iliac on that side and lead to venous back pressure in that region and potentially lead to similar symptoms. Or an alternative is compression of the left renal vein in what has previously been called nutcracker syndrome, so where you get stenosis of the left renal vein, and that therefore causes back pressure on the left ovarian vein and can lead to symptoms in a similar way to primary reflux.
Yeah, so as you say, two quite different broad categories of cause. And as you've explained in the article, I guess it's very important to identify the difference because the treatment implications will be quite different. But we'll probably come on to the treatment a bit later. Before we get on to that, let's talk about the diagnosis and how can the diagnosis be made and what's the role of imaging in that?
Yeah, so I think imaging has a fundamental role to play, but it is essential that it's correlated with the patient's clinical symptoms. And the reason for that is that it's known that there are a number of women who will have dilated veins in the pelvis or the gonadal veins, which could be attributable to pelvic venous insufficiency, but they are completely asymptomatic. So it's very important that it's a combination of a clinical and radiological diagnosis. From a clinical point of view, the suggestive history is more typical in premenopausal women. It is possible in postmenopausal women, but again, that tends to be more perhaps the secondary obstructive causes, or then you have to be careful about making a diagnosis until you've thought carefully about what the other potential causes of this pain could be. It's more common in multiple women, as we discussed, and it typically gives a chronic pelvic ache, which is worse on standing or after prolonged walking, for example, and then tends to be relieved on lying. There's also consideration that postcoital ache is a relatively common symptom. And then on examination, it's been reported that tenderness in the adnexa, and particularly in combination with postcoital ache, can be a relatively sensitive combination of signs and symptoms. And then when you then consider the secondary obstructive causes, then iliac venous compression, as we talked about, typically will present with lower limb venous claudication or DVT, whilst left renal vein compression will typically present with more left flank pain, usually in combination with hematuria. And that then leads on to correlating that with the radiology findings. And this is, a difficult area because there are no clear definitions about what is normal and what is abnormal. And that's borne out both from variable reporting in the literature, but also no consensus definition about what a normal sized ovarian vein, for example, may be. And typically, it's described in descriptive terms, so dilated ovarian, paraovarian, parauterine veins, arcuate or myometrial veins are also being commonly described. And then non-saphenous venous varicosities can also be seen. So they're typically related to areas in the posteromedial thigh, in the vulva or the pelvic floor. And they're typically considered to be areas of internal iliac escape points. So if you've got internal iliac insufficiency, where the veins are there going to drain out. And then it can also be, when you're having a look at the secondary obstructive causes, looking for reasons why you may have obstruction. So that is similar to looking for internal iliac compression or left renal compression in the context of those obstructive causes. And so that's really where the combination of imaging and clinical diagnosis, I think, is absolutely essential in this, and not to make the diagnosis purely based on one or either of those factors.
Yeah, Ben, and I think that's a really important point you make. I think this is one of those instances where it's so important, as you've said, to take the imaging findings in conjunction with the clinical signs and symptoms. So I think that's a very useful thing to bear in mind for anyone listening. And in terms of the kind of various different imaging modalities, what would you recommend as being the best to aid in the diagnosis of this condition?
So I think it would depend on the question that's being asked. Now, obviously, these women typically are premenopausal. So avoiding ionizing radiation is obviously preferable. And ultrasound, because of its it's common, availability, and also its role in investigating for other causes of chronic pelvic pain, is very useful, and most commonly the first and perhaps the only investigation that's required in a lot of these patients. It's also got significant advantages which aren't necessarily available in other modalities. So provocation manoeuvres such as Valsalva or standing the patient up can be performed with ultrasound, and you can also assess for dynamic flow, so looking specifically for venous reflux in for example the left ovarian vein has been demonstrated on ultrasound, and so it's a very useful and I think probably the first go-to modality. Other modalities, so particularly thinking about cross-sectional modality of CT and MR, clearly have a role. And they can be very useful for certain things, and particularly in obstructive causes. But as a first line investigation, I think they don't have as much of an importance as ultrasound. It does have an importance when it comes to considering treatment planning, which we can kind of just talk about maybe when we talk about the treatments as well.
That's really interesting, actually, because I probably wouldn't have thought of ultrasound as the first line in terms of what came to my mind, but actually for the reasons you've highlighted, that sounds completely sensible. I might ask you at this point, actually, what tips would you give a general radiologist who's involved in the diagnosis of this condition? And at what point do you think specialist intervention or opinion would be appropriate or helpful?
Yes. So I think the main things is just to be the awareness of the condition, and that whilst it is probably an under-recognised condition, there is also a significant risk of overdiagnosis based purely on imaging, and that very much ties in with what we discussed previously about the importance of tying this in with their clinical symptoms. So where available, if there is a history of pelvic pain, chronic pelvic pain, then suggesting that the findings of venous dilation could be attributable to or can be seen in pelvic venous insufficiency, I think, would be very helpful. But it's obviously essential that patient is then seen by someone who is knowledgeable about the condition and potential treatments. And I think in the context of younger women who are presenting, who may have had imaging for a completely unrelated reason, if there was consideration that, you know, this chronic pain could be attributable to this, then referral, usually to a gynecologist, would likely be the first recommendation. In the context of obstructive causes, however, and they again very common to see incidentally with no clinical significance at the time of imaging, and that's particularly being reported in left renal vein and iliac compression, but if there is concern that this is clinically significant, then they're typically referred through to the vascular surgeons, and particularly so at my institution there's a vascular surgeon with a special interest in venous diseases, and they will typically see the patient and assess them clinically to decide if then further investigations and management is required. So I think overall it's really a kind of recognition that this is a condition that does exist, but not to jump to making a diagnosis again purely based on the imaging, and to suggest, you know, appropriate clinical consultation if felt necessary.
Yeah, thanks. And definitely very useful to understand that pathway a little more as well, for if we come across this in our kind of general reporting. So you kind of alluded to this before, but in terms of treatments, what are the treatment options, and specifically what's the role of IR in these treatments?
So IR has a very important role to play in this condition. So I think firstly, again, splitting these things into whether the underlying etiology is of reflux or whether it's of obstruction is firstly important. In reflux, really IR plays the central role in the treatment. Medical management has been used, but actually the results tend to be relatively transient, if effective at all. And surgery is really only reserved for a very select few cases. So typically IR has the major role to play, and it in the same way it does with varicocele treatment, the aim is to firstly to investigate for and then to embolize any significantly reflux in veins. It involves doing this under in the interventional suite and essentially doing direct angiography to look and assess the vessels. And that's firstly important to, whilst the ultrasound, for example, and the clinical symptoms could be suggestive, the first stage is normally to confirm that diagnosis on venography, to confirm whether there is truly venous dilation and reflux. Mm-hmm. And at that point, if there is, then to go ahead and treat. And that involves then assessing all territories that are potentially involved. So it can be difficult to know where the incompetent vein or veins are based purely just on preoperative imaging. So typically what will happen is to interrogate each of the ovarian veins and the internal iliac veins, and then assess to see if there is evidence of significant reflux and associated venous dilation, and then to look at occluding those. And that's done typically with a combination or any of things like coils or sclerosant foam or glue has been used in some situations, all with an aim really just to try and occlude that vessel and then exclude it from that venous circulation and allow the venous drainage to then go via presumed competent routes. In comparison, if there's an obstructive cause, then the treatment is very different. It's still, IR still plays a central role, and particularly in the context of iliac vein compression, then venous investigation, so plastying and stenting, are the central treatments that are typically performed. But again, there's a lot of consideration about whether you are treating this just in the context of venous insufficiency, because actually these patients typically, as we discussed, are presenting with lower limb symptoms. And if you're placing a stent, particularly in a young patient, that stent's going to be in place for many decades. And they, of course, have their associated complications, both in the short and longer term. And so the clinical decision-making in those contexts can be a lot more challenging. And that's where intraoperative investigations, things like IVUS, so intravascular ultrasound, and pressure gradient measuring, can be helpful in terms of working that out. But it, of course, like everything, is IR doesn't play the only role. Surgery can sometimes have a role. And that's more common in the context of left renal vein compression, where stenting is generally only infrequently performed because of the concern about stent migration. And more commonly than surgical procedures, so either vein transposition or ovarian vein transposition, where essentially the ovarian vein is anastomosed onto the IVC to essentially form the drainage of that left kidney, might be more commonly performed than an endovascular treatment.
Yeah. So definitely sounds like there's a lot to think about when thinking about the treatment, depending on the various different causes. But actually, whilst you were talking, it just made me reflect on how great it is that these IR treatments are available, which are so minimally invasive and can make a huge difference for these people who are suffering with this condition. Whereas before, perhaps the only option, if any, might have been quite an invasive surgery.
Yes, and particularly I think when you're thinking that these patients are you know, typically younger women,
yeah.
You know, a hysterectomy is clearly a treatment which I'm sure many patients would not want to even consider. So the, you know, the option to have this done minimally invasively as a day case is, I think a great thing. And I think as well that, you know, the results demonstrate that as well. You know, it does have of the evidence that's available, which is admittedly relatively thin, but of that there was a systematic review that pooled all of these results that showed that, you know, about 75% or so demonstrated significant symptom improvement around the 4 to 6 week period. And that did seem to be sustained over the studies that have had longer term follow-up up to 5 or 6 years. So it does seem to be an effective treatment in the correct patient population.
Yep, definitely. So the last thing I might ask you about is, in the paper you mention a recently published consensus classification of symptomatic pelvic venous insufficiency, which hopefully should aid in classifying and treating these patients. Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so this has been an attempt, so it's a worldwide or international consensus to try and attempt to classify this condition a bit more. So as we mentioned earlier on, the part of the difficulty has been the confusing nomenclature that's being used, and also the fact that those terminologies have been used to classify patients that have actually got potentially quite different underlying etiologies. So this consensus guidance is essentially recommends splitting these into three categories. So it's called the SVP, or symptoms, varices, pathophysiology classification, and the aim is to basically summarize where the symptoms are arising. So are they typically pelvic symptoms, or are they extra pelvic varicose symptoms, so outside of the saphenous distribution, so in the external genitalia, for example. The second part is then where the varices are from a clinical point of view or from radiological investigation, and then to assess where the pathophysiological cause of it lies. And that's split into the anatomical consideration. So is there left renal vein compression, or is there gonadal vein dilation, whether the hemodynamics are of obstruction or reflux, and then is the etiology a thrombotic or non-thrombotic occlusion, for example, in the context of an iliofemoral DVT. And the aim of all of this is to try and improve the communication between clinicians, but also to allow a more homogeneous groups to be formed, which will then aid in further research in this area, which up until now has been somewhat limited by the trials that exist, both in number but also in ability to compare between trials, partly because of, as I mentioned, the relatively loose classifications that have been used up until now.
Yeah, definitely sounds like it's needed and will be very useful if it is widely taken up. So I guess it's been a very, very useful discussion. Did you have any final thoughts?
I think it's just an area. I think it's an interesting area from the combination of both diagnostics and also interventional radiology. And as you mentioned, you know, it's great that we have all of these tools available to us to be able to try and you know, advance the care for these patients, because I think it can be you know, fairly debilitating but relatively silent condition for a lot of patients. I think one of the main things is the difficulties in the decision making in this, both in terms of the diagnosis but also in terms of who you should treat, when you should treat them, how you should treat them, and what you should treat them with. And I think that's a really interesting area that will be that really is crying out for some more research to be done.
Yeah, well, I'll certainly be looking forward to seeing some more work from you in that case. Thanks again, Tom. That was a really useful discussion on often quite a poorly understood topic, clearly. And one more thing I'd probably mention finally before we finish is that often, obviously, the anatomy can be quite difficult to get your head around as well. And I found the figures that you've included in the article itself really helpful to illustrate the different causes and kind of really picture what you're talking about. So I would really recommend anyone listening to have a look at the article itself as well. And on that note, we have come to the end of the episode for this time. Thank you all for tuning into the podcast, and do make sure to keep up with the latest ClinRad news and articles through the website and Twitter page.